welcome to the Heritage Radio Network on tour at Charleston Wine and Food Festival 2022. I'm Sam Benrubi from the Grape Nation, and today we are broadcasting live from the heart of the Culinary Village. Our guest is Eric Asimov, chief wine critic for the New York Times. Eric, welcome back to Heritage and the festival. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much, Sam. It's great to be here.
I want to talk to you about a few things that you recently wrote about, and I want to lead with natural wine. You said for 20 years, natural wine has been dismissed as a fad or a fraud, yet more people make it, more people are drinking it, and good bottles are easier to find. So 20 years later, you know, when you kind of reference that, where are we at with natural wine and how do we define it? I mean, do we see it differently than we first saw it? How has it evolved?
Well, I think that the people who have been anti-natural wine probably have not evolved, but there's a growing group of people who are interested in it. And I think, you know, in the context of popular culture, 20 years is a long time. And steady growth during that time within the limits of the natural wine milieu show that there's something about it that's really attractive to the wine audience, particularly to young people.
So that was my next question. The wine audience. Who, when we're talking natural wines, who is the audience? Can it be kind of cornered into mostly millennials, or it's even wider than that?
Well, I'm reluctant to try to take a stab at that, although
okay.
I think that a lot of millennials are drawn to it, and this is just, you know, very impressionistic evidence, but, you know, when you are looking at restaurants that are serving natural wines and bars, wine bars that are serving natural wines, they tend to be in areas with a lot of younger people. And I think this is illuminating for the American wine industry, at least, that says millennials aren't buying enough wine.
Generally, they're just less of a consumer.
You know, they are wringing their hands, maybe rightfully, and complaining that they're losing out to spirits and beer and hard seltzer and all these things.
Do you think, like, health and lifestyle's an issue? They just drink less than maybe you and I did when we were that age?
Health and lifestyle may be an issue, and that, you know, that may lead to the erroneous assumption that, you know, if you're drinking natural wine, it's going to make you healthier. The same way that some people have capitalized on this impression by creating clean wine, so-called. But I think that the area that it really draws people in is the idea that natural wines might be better for the planet,
right,
than
I want to get into that
wines. The agriculture might be better. There are fewer additives. If people are concerned about you know, buying organic foods or getting CSA boxes and things like that, it's sort of a natural inroad to natural wine. But more than that, even, they think it tastes better.
So when I meant the health and fitness thing, you brought up a good point that the wines themselves can be perceived as organic, natural. I'm talking about people are just drinking less alcohol because they're more into staying in shape and all of that. I mean, is that part of the millennia? It's hard to say, right?
It's hard for me to say. I mean, I know people who do dry Januaries and things like that, and it's not necessarily younger people who are going that route.
Right.
It's a lot of, you know, middle-aged people like me who are wondering how to keep the weight off.
Right. Right. Do you think the things that you mentioned, you know, that there's a story behind a lot of the wines, a lot of the wines are farming organically, there's an eye towards regenerative farming more than other things, do you think that's what's attractive to, let's say, millennials or younger on natural wine? I mean, do they give a crap more about that, you know, than the consumer that's been around 20 years?
I think that's part of the equation. I think, you know, people are, younger people especially, are concerned with climate change. They're concerned
right.
with the planet. And, you know, if you are not necessarily gonna, if farming organically or biodynamically or with fewer water inputs as a winemaker, it's not gonna change the bigger picture as far as climate change. Nothing's gonna change that until governments get their acts together and,
right.
and
that's
do
a,
what's necessary.
But
every little piece helps, and I think people feel that they don't want to contribute to the problem any more than they have to. But, you know, I think it's really hard to single out one element. I think it's part of the idea that there's greater purity in the product, that it's more conscientious to farm the way they do, and because the flavors are better. And I'm sure some element is the lack of pretension and the informality of the milieu. I mean, natural wine has basically rejected the idea that wine belongs on a pedestal.
Right.
And this right. idea of the pedestal has intimidated people forever, you know, and
it
made
didn't
people
help the
anxious
cause.
About
yeah.
about wine. Natural wine contributes to taking that element out of it. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways that you can look at it, you know, and probably not least of which is that's what my friends are drinking.
Right, right.
But
is it fair to bring up the consistency point? There was a time where it seemed 5, 10, 8, 12, even the 20 years ago that natural wines didn't have the consistency, things that they are now, they were then, but weren't understood, whether it was cloudy. Vintage to vintage, which varies with any good wines, was really, you know, wide. Are the wines better now? It's kind of a general silly question, but can you react to that?
It's hard to say, but I think that you have more good producers and fewer producers who are rationalizing flawed wines. You know, wine floors flaws are a fraught subject.
Right.
And it's very easy to say, you know, if you are a manufacturer of mass-produced processed wines, to ridicule the flaws of natural wines. But from my point of view, I think boring wine is a flawed wine. A wine that's stripped of all character is flawed by definition. So what are we comparing?
I agree.
I think that it's okay to say, for the sake of having a living wine, a wine that can change and evolve, if I get an occasional flawed wine in the bunch, that's something I will live with. And I think that's what a lot of people in natural wine would say. I don't think it's okay to have a horribly bready wine or a terribly mousy wine and say, it's fine.
Right.
You know, I
mean,
I don't like drinking
face
those
it. Yeah.
wines.
Yeah. It's just not a good wine.
But part of that has come with more experience on the part of winemakers, greater financing. So, you know, one of the reasons you had flawed wines is that producers were not able to age them enough. They had to make them and sell them
right.
to finance themselves.
Right.
And I think with mousiness in particular, you have to give the wines a little bit more age to grow out of whatever tendency they
does
might have.
Does that help mousiness? If wine exists in mousiness, are you telling me that if you let it sit a little longer in age, that mousiness will...
That's what a lot of people have said and a lot of people have told me. I don't have the scientific evidence to back that up.
But wouldn't that be based on you had a 2018 2014 bottle. You tasted it when it came out.
It's, I mean, it's
and then
not
4 years later.
No, I mean, it's not quite like that.
No?
You know, it's more as if you have to give it sufficient age before putting it on the market.
Right. Right.
And that's what a lot of people... There's a growing consensus there.
Good point on that.
But it's still somewhat up in the air, and there's a lot of disagreement. And
yeah. I wanted to point something out. When you were talking about natural wine in your column, you tasted 12 different wines. And, you know, we don't need to get into the wines. But what was very amazing and impressive to me was of the 12 wines you selected, 10 of them were from different countries. And, you know, people who think natural wine, you know, initially think the Loire, maybe Jura, you know, Italy, parts of it. But there's such a diversity now in, you know, everyone that's making what, you know, is natural wine. I guess it wasn't hard to find, you know, all these wines. So...
Well, in a place like New York or other urban centers, I think you can find them pretty well. But I think it says a lot that you can find 12 really good natural wines from 10 different countries. And it just shows how the wine culture is evolving. You know, it used to be that you would have small groups in a particular site, a place where... You know, you would get together and make decisions and influence each other. But that's happening, in far-flung communities now. People who are connected by not just visiting each other at festivals or, you know, traveling to visit a particular producer, but through, social media and internet where people can discuss things and help each other. And it also shows that regardless of the efforts of people in the mainstream of wine to dismiss natural wine, there is this continuing evolution and attraction of it, not just, you know, among a certain group of people who are confined to urban centers, but all over the world. And, you know, as people like Alice Firing have pointed out, that, you know, it brings dangers of, you know, bigger companies now trying to capitalize on whatever profits they perceive in it and sort of, doing the equivalent of green mailing with natural wine.
I'm sad to say that there's an inevitability to that. You know, I think you're going to see some people sort of gaming the natural.
Well, that's why a lot of people have wanted to see some sort of firm definition or labeling.
That's a slippery slope, too.
Yeah, I don't believe in that because I think that, you know, once you do that, people figure out how to get into it, and inevitably the standards get relaxed. And, you know, just as you've seen with the definition of organic in our country. And I think that there's a little bit of an educational process that's necessary to find natural wines, and that's not a bad thing. It's, you know, it's one making it simple for consumers has its attractions, but also making people learn about what it is so they can recognize it is also effective.
Do you think, so I think it's going to be hard to, you know, define everything. I think it's going to take time. I think it may happen for natural wines. But do you think when that time comes, things are going to have to be organic, biodynamic, regenerative? That's what's going to define what a natural wine is, or it may not, you know, have to go that
well,
deep.
Well, I mean, it should definitely go that far. I mean, I don't think you can compromise on the farming. And you have to also be clear about the processes involved in making the wine. And, You know, when once you get governments and big companies involved, as you said, a very slippery slope.
Yeah. You were talking about the internet, and we were talking offline a little, and I just want you to talk about it a little more. The internet has been an amazing thing for wine, you know, for sommeliers, bottle shots, influencers, you know, people just, you know, mine's bigger than yours, look at this picture type thing.
Right.
But I want you to talk a little more about that. The wine community is obviously spread out all over the world, and they would get together one way or another at a fair, festival, or traveling. But the internet has tied them together on everything, you know, not bottle shots, not but growing and technique and science and analytics. And that's made a community and made it smaller and better, right?
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about wine culture, this has always been something that's been defined by geographical proximity. And that's been true for centuries.
But wait, help me understand that better. The geographical proximity of the winemakers?
Yes. You know, when you think of wine culture, in some ways it's an integral part of what we call terroir.
Right.
You know, you have the soil, the climate, the elevation, the angle toward the sun, but you also have the culture of the people making the wine. And this culture has helped define what grapes they use, what methods, traditions that go toward the wine, how you make decisions, which are always often tradition-based. And, you know, in a way, this was the defining feature of what we often call old-world winemaking, whereas the new world, without these cultural traditions, was more often defined by entrepreneurship and cultural considerations.
Right.
But the internet in its current state has kind of thrown this formulation or almost gotten rid of this formulation because your senses of community are no longer limited to geography. You've got people all over the world in constant conversation about methods, best practices.
So if you're a multi-generational winemaking family and you're like the 34-year-old son who's taking over, the world you have in front of you with the internet is way different than that guy's grandfather as far as how far you can go, what you could do,
well,
what you could learn.
You know, it's also part of a continuum because the third and fourth generation of these family estates are, you know, they're now going to enological school somewhere.
Right.
They're inevitably, right, you know, going halfway around the world to do a stage or an internship, working for a year. Then they come back to the family. So you're already, you know, infiltrating very insular cultures with other ideas. But this is just amplifying and accelerating the process.
Yeah. I think it's wonderful. And, you know, the change is just so much, you know, for the better. And
you know,
I think we're at the infancy of it.
And that's why, you know, you for years, for example, you would have in southern Chile, and I'm writing about this in an upcoming column, you know, farmers who've been growing grapes there forever, often mission grapes or things that were brought by conquistadors.
Right.
And these grapes and the wines that they made were dismissed by the big companies because they're not what, you know, that's not what sells in America or Europe or Japan. They want Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet and this process in the last 10 years where, you know, not only have you had people locally in Chile, you know, meeting these rural communities who are just making fresh Pipeño wines,
right,
from Mission and San So or whatever happened to be growing in these ancient vineyards. But you've got people traveling from Chile to Europe, and
right,
then you've got people making friends and conferring with each other and saying, hey, why don't we send some of that Pipeño to us? And suddenly something that was just regarded as only for the locals is showing up in other parts of the world. And there's an audience and a thirst for these wines because we're all now, you know, people everywhere are part of this community.
I was just going to say there's a thirst by the maker to make them. Yes. And there's a thirst by the market to embrace them, which is a very good combination.
You know, the danger comes when globalization, which, you know, it can homogenize, but it can also expose people to the great diversity of the world, you know?
Right.
But does the process of turning a local product into a global product change that local product? That's always a tension here.
Yeah, that's a big issue. I guess we're going to start seeing examples of that at some point. All right, let me shift gears. We're winding down. You've been a champion of Chianti Classico. You and I have been talking about it. We've talked about it here. We talked about it on the Grape Nation show. You're actually doing a tasting here tomorrow for Chianti Classico, which should be interesting. It's part of the schedule. You have also expressed an appreciation that I picked up on, you know, the way I did with Chianti Classico, about Spanish wines.
Yes.
And you noted something that caught my attention, that new producers seem to be interested in these old vines in some specific regions. And it's sort of this, what's old is new in Spain now. You know,
Absolutely. They
embrace these. Talk to me about some of the regions, you know, specifically, you know, our friends at Envinati. I mean, tell me what these guys are doing and the significance, which you brought up.
You know, it's a similar situation to what we were just talking about in Chile, where you've got, here you have in Europe, you know, historic wine-producing worlds that were not recognized as the top echelon like France. And so when they started to enter the global economy, they did the same thing. Oh, you know, Americans want Cabernet, they want Merlot, they want modern wines aged in oak barrels, new oak barrels. And you saw a kind of a rejection of what was local and traditional. And so in different areas of the country, you have these old vineyards of Garnacha, as Grenache is originally known because it came from Spain,
right?
Or Carignan, or, you know, other grapes that were just kind of, you know, dismissed as, you know, we don't need those. Let's rip those vines out and plant Merlot on the flat ground.
It's crazy.
You know, you have those beautiful, but it's so much work on the hill, the granite hillside.
Right.
We've got this fertile area. We can plant Merlot. Nobody wants that, but they want what's distinctive and wonderful. So you've got this new generation of people. You know, people like Commando G is sort of the emblem of.
But Daniel, is that Daniel Landy?
Yeah. Daniel and
yeah, and the Envinati guys, the 3-4 friends.
Yes, Laura Lorenzo.
Right.
All of these people who are prospecting the country for these great old vineyards and making wonderful wines, and these are people who were. Their influence comes from, you know, maybe it's Burgundy, maybe, you know, other, like, highly traditional terroir-conscious areas that made people think, you know, we've got old vineyards, we've got traditions, we've got great terroirs, let's showcase what we have right here in a way that maybe it's never been showcased before.
And they're all dedicated to farming without chemicals,
yes.
You know, no treatments, low intervention in the cellar.
And honestly, Sam, you know, this is a great thing that's been going on all over the world. You can point to, you know, the effort to preserve heritage vineyards in California, 100 old Zinfandel and mixed black vineyards, the effort to preserve old mixed vineyards on Mount Etna.
It's great.
You know, it's a great thing.
And the
can I say one more
of
thing?
Of course.
Because this ties it back to natural wine. one of the achievements of natural wine was to say, you know, you guys, you, the wine bureaucrats are saying we can only grow these modern grapes here, but what about Pinot d'Anis? You know, we've made, that's a tradition here. They stood up and said, no, we're not going to pull out our traditional grapes. We're going to keep making wine from it, even if we have to call it Vin de France or
some people do that.
Generic appellation. Yeah. And I think that helps.
They're bucking the system by doing what they want, and they'll label it. People are going to find it anyway.
Right.
Which I think is terrific. The cool thing about Spain is, you know, Spain's known for its Rioja and Priorat. These are regions, you know, all over, you know, Canary Islands, Ribera, which is, you know, really cool.
I mean, Spain is full of so many great wines that are, you know, rejuvenated in the last 25 years or so.
Yeah, it's great. We have to wrap up, but I wanted to ask you one thing. You know, we've been in a COVID world and, you know, we locked ourselves up a little, but we're here talking. Are you, for work, going to be hitting the road to some interesting places?
I mean, I hope so.
Okay.
You know, I've got a backlog of stories that require
so you have
traveling
to get out
to
at
those
some
places.
Okay.
And, you know, when we had that brief interlude before Delta last year, everybody thought we were kind of past it, and I went out to California and Oregon. You know, I'm hoping to get going again this year, and I've got trips to France and Spain and South Africa and Italy and Greece that are all, whenever I can do them, I'm ready.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been reading, you know, your columns for a long, long time. And to me, when you travel, you're just there and just get a better sense. The people, the culture, you know, tasting it with those guys. For you getting out there and then writing about it, to me, you know, connects even more.
I think it's really important with wine. I mean, it's one thing to sit at your table and taste a bunch of wines and you can, you know, recommend bottles. But when you are able to get to see people on their home turf, to walk the vineyard, to smell the vineyard, experience the culture, it really informs me about the wine, and I hope I'm then therefore able to inform
readers. That's the point I'm making.
Better.
You don't hope, it does. All right, we have to wrap up. I want to thank our guest, Eric Asimov from the New York Times. You could read Eric's writings every week. Let's just go over that quickly, Eric. You have the, now with the internet, you have to help me. You have your Wednesday column, which comes out a day or two early.
If you get the actual Times newspaper, my column is in every Wednesday. Usually that Wednesday column is posted the Thursday before. So almost a full week before, but not always because things happen.
So if you're anxious, use the internet. And then you do wine school and you do other tasting stuff.
This
How does that?
Wine school is a monthly column. It's all part of my, you know, weekly column rotation. But wine school is a great thing. And the idea is that we learn about wine by drinking it.
Right.
Not by tasting it, not by reading about it, although that all helps. But actually drinking it with food, with your friends and family in a social situation, and paying attention to it. And doing this repeatedly with a great diversity of wine helps to develop a sense of what you like, what you don't like, and a sense of ease with your own taste.
It's great. So that occurs pretty much regularly. All right, we got to wrap up. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network's live coverage of Charleston Wine and Food Festival. I'm Sam Benrubi from the Grape Nation. We're grateful to the festival for having HRN back in the Culinary Village for the sixth year running. So 6 years. Eric, this is three for you and me. You can listen to all of our coverage on our podcast, Heritage Radio Network On Tour. Find it on heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you, and thank you, Eric, again.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.